So first of all, thank you for coming back if you were here yesterday, and thank you for coming if you weren't here yesterday. Just get this clip on properly. Okay, I'm keen to have a sense that what I've planned for today is actually going to work before we do it, because it depends a lot on who's really in the room. I was reflecting on how yesterday had gone, and the fact that the majority of people seem to be leaders rather than musicians in church. And the emphasis of yesterday kind of is okay for that. Today is very practical in terms of my plan. And it may be that we do something a little more dynamic and decide to have a conversation rather than me just give the talk that I prepared. It just depends. But to know what the best way is forward, I need to get a sense of who's in the room. So I guess it'd be good to know how many of you are players in church. Okay. Not a huge number. Okay. Singers? Okay. How many of you are in leadership in church? Okay. And any other reasons for coming to this? How many of you are lost in the university? Okay. Are there any other roles that I haven't covered? So we've got some play. Yeah. Pardon?
Visuals.
Okay. Yes. Some technical support, if you like, or. Musicians are providing support for the technical, whatever way you want to see it. Okay. Right, well, what I'll do very quickly is summarise yesterday in about 2 minutes flat. How many of you were here yesterday? And how many were not? Okay. I'm going to take a couple of minutes to summarise the background that we did yesterday and then move on to very much more practical stuff that we're doing today. Essentially, we started yesterday by looking at the role of the worship leader, who came to the conclusion that the only one who can stand and say that they're leading us in worship truly, in a theological sense, is Jesus, because he's the one who leads us to God, and he's the one by whom we come into his presence, and before God we can stand because of everything Jesus has done. So anything we do must not stand in the way of the work of Jesus or draw away attention from him. It must all be about pointing towards him and helping. And that means that if Jesus is the worship leader, then everyone who's been brought to God by Jesus is part of the congregation, which is the worship team. So the idea that you have a band who are in charge of worship, and then the congregation come along as passive participants, or passive observers rather than proper participants, fully involved in the process, is a mad one. We've got to think of everybody in the congregation as being a worshipper in the very truest and fullest sense of making their whole bodies, their whole lives, living sacrifices for God. And then the third thing then is that what you then end up with is a description of the people at the front, which is much, it's much more wordy and bland, but it's that they're serving facilitators. They're getting on with the job because they've been chosen for the gifting that they have to do something which serves the church in the same way as the person who cuts the grass is using the lawnmower. They're using the piano or the guitar or whatever it is to do something that is their little natural role in God's great kingdom. And for those of you who sat through the sort of 30-minute journey on that path yesterday, I'm sorry to repeat it again, and we probably could have done it that fast and made the point, but there we are, we've done it again now. So those of you who have come just today have got the best value for money in terms of a musician trying to talk theology in a practical way, but there we are. We then talked about how people should go about leading worship, and we talked about this idea of synergy, where you have people working together in a way where you get 1 + 1 equaling more than 2, so that you're talking about communicating in advance of services to talk about the plan, having a clear sense of who is actually running the plan, because I think half times the problems are caused by people not having a clear sense of what their role is in their place, not having a clear sense of when to expect information that might help them to prepare for the service, if they're picking songs, or indeed, you know, who even has that responsibility of deciding what a church sings over time, all those sorts of things. And the whole idea of working together with people and trying to avoid anything that's territorial or hurried, and actually be reflective and proactive in making sure it works for everybody. And then looking carefully at the environment to try and remove anything that distracts us from the business of meeting together to sing and worship God in a corporate sense. Things like maybe not necessarily having the musicians in a really prominent position at the front, people over the side, things that enable you as the congregation and them as the musicians not to feel like an us and them, but to feel like we are all doing this together. And sometimes that's about physical attributes of the room. So if you have a situation where you have a proper stage that's all closed in, you know, and you've got a phenomenal lighting rig and things like that, sometimes that actually can be a distancing factor, particularly if the congregation become like an audience of a theatre in the dark. And that, I find, can be a difficult thing because it stops people feeling that we are doing. I guess in my mind, the most natural way of looking at congregational singing is that it's more like what you do when you're at a football match and everybody's asserting their identity together, except that you've got something more meaningful to assert it about than whether the ball goes in the net. I know that's a controversial statement, but you know what I mean. And I think feeling it as that sort of raw expression of identity is a really helpful way of seeing congregational singing. It's we're taking ownership of the thing we're singing about, and warts and all, then it's heard as what it is, rather than this thing where you have a professional band up front and an audience who sort of sing an octave or two octaves down because they can't quite manage to be part of the production that's happening in front of them. So look carefully at the environment and see what you can do to help that. Okay, so occasionally I get a phone call that goes a little bit like this. Jonathan, I say, you don't know me, but I'm the minister of Ballygunnilure Presbyterian Church, and I'm wondering if you might be able to help us. Our organist, Albert, has decided to retire now that he's reached his 903rd birthday, and after 874 years of service at the console each Sunday and dedicated commitment to the leadership of our choir of two altos, a bass and a guide dog, we are now in the position of trying to find some sort of replacement. Now, things have moved on a wee bit, Jonathan, and, you know, we're really going for a more of a contemporary slant. There's a way to say contemporary slant that makes you think they're not really serious. We have a couple of young ones who play in a wee worship band from time to time, about once a month, and some of what they've been doing, you know, it's been okay. And what we're really looking for is, you know, someone who can take on the direction of that and take things forward a wee bit. And then at this point, the conversation goes one of three ways. Usually, either we're not so worried about whether the new person can deal with the organ and the choir. We're keen to use this, you know, as an opportunity to move forward. Or we're really keen to get somebody who can keep the old members of the congregation happy at the same time as bringing the young ones on and developing them. And I'm not really sure if the people would come with us, you know, if we were to do anything that was less traditional. Or I guess the most difficult one is I'm looking for somebody to really help navigate through the change with me. And you sort of, you smell what that really means. You're going to end up in the middle of a really controversial situation that's going to get very, very hot indeed very quickly. So to get this straight, these guys who phone are looking for a competent musician who's extremely flexible, musically flexible, but also flexible as a human being with emotional intelligence and stuff like that that's going to help it work in the church. They're looking for somebody who's a supportive Christian, who's behind the overall ministry of the church and gets what they're trying to do. They're looking for somebody who's wanting to combine past tradition with present innovation and willing to help the church with the diplomatic nightmare of navigating through the political upheaval of changing the musical culture. And above all, willing to protect the minister from the very centre of the row. And you can imagine it's not always easy. Sorry, that's very unfair to those of you in leadership. I'm exaggerating to make the point. Okay, it's kind of like, you know those medical assessments where you have to describe your typical day and you describe everything you've ever done in every day, and it suddenly sounds like you've got this incredibly dense day where you're, yeah, it's a bit like that. This is kind of a conflation of all the phone calls like this I've ever had. And you can imagine I don't find it very easy to help ministers who are in that position. And then they drop the killer sentence. It is, of course, a competitive position. And depending on whether it's Ballygoan Working Class or Ballygoan 454, they sometimes even name the available amount or whatever. And the trouble is that despite having this huge database of people in New Irish Arts on my computer, sometimes it's very, very difficult to even make one recommendation who would fit even part of what they're trying to say and trying to look for. Which leads me to the obvious question, what do we do when that ID isn't available? Sure, there are a small number of churches who manage to combine all the elements of traditional and modern, the organ, the choir, the worship band, lead singers, instrumentalists, the orchestra, the handbell ringers and the BB bagpipes, in one glorious cacophony of musical success. But what do you do if that's not possible? What should Ballygoan Normal Church's combination of music and worship look like? And how do we do our very best in local church music, even when the resources are limited? Well, we've already covered lots of stuff about attitudes and principles and collaboration and things like that. We talked a little bit yesterday about the whole idea that musicians are conditioned from a very young age to having their work applauded, so that they play when they've been playing the clarinet for 4 weeks. And then, you know, everybody clapped seeing those there. But later on, then they become adults, sometimes in the professional music world, and they still expect to get a round of applause when they finish their work. And you don't applaud anybody else in professional life just because they've done their job. And that's a weird thing in their psychology that sometimes leads either in church musicians to a sense of, I'm not worthy of anybody saying I'm good or the song's good or whatever, or, oh gosh, I'm amazing and aren't these gifts very, very special? And those are both dangerous things in church life. So we've talked a lot about that sort of thing yesterday and tried to see how the whole idea of Jesus as the worship leader releases us from that and actually frees us up to enjoy having a role where we're simply serving God's people the same way as everybody else. You know, somebody who puts the thing out is doing the same thing. And if you see it like that, then it's actually very liberating for people who feel that they're not worthy to do the job, or people who are totally overinflated with their own sense of importance in the universe. So today we're going to move on to some specifically musical issues. The first one kind of is somewhere in, whoops, square pegs in round holes. I left that sentence in. Musical issues. We're going to talk about rehearsals, arrangements, playing in church. Do you know what? I'm in the wrong PowerPoint presentation, I think. No, we're not. We're okay. Rehearsing? Yeah, that's right. So now the other slide should have been gone. Always prepare. So this is an edited version of something to try and take six sessions into two, which is why it's like that. But anyway, the first thing is about choosing strategically songs, what we sing in church. Then about rehearsing sensibly and arranging sensitively and playing supportively. And if I hadn't been so overcome by the wrong slide being up a minute ago, I would have made a joke about the alliteration being as a sort of half Presbyterian. Now I'm getting some of the culture and assuming it. After that, we're going to have a little bit of question and answer, and hopefully then some talk about developing gifts if we have time to do that. So choosing strategically, first of all. One thing is that you'll notice that there's a recurring phrase in this where I talk about things that might help you. And I will say that there are some bits that are useful to everybody, and there are some bits that you just need to throw away and discard because they're not appropriate to your situation. So let's pray actually now together for wisdom as we go through these issues and talk about some things that are actually quite banal, and ask that the Lord will help us to take some things that are useful for us and then discard the things that are not of value in our case. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the gift of music and for the constant encouragement in your word to sing to the Lord and to bring praises to you. And I thank you for the roles that all the people who are in this room fulfill in their local congregations. And I thank you for their willingness to spend time now reflecting on how those can be better implemented. And I pray, Lord, that for every person who is here, there will be something useful today to take home that might make them think, maybe not even something that's said directly, but something that just stimulates a thought in a direction that I have never even thought of, but it comes from you and it helps them to serve better. We ask all this for the glory of the name of Jesus. Amen. So there are lots of issues we could consider when we talk about the actual content of a church service. How do you involve different people up front so that it's not always the same faces and voices? What other elements are worth including in services besides songs? You know, corporate reading, drama, storytelling, spoken links, video, live music, for the congregation to listen to maybe even sometimes rather than be part of. There's tons of room for creativity and really very little excuse for having a service which is identical every week. I could also talk for a while about the importance of making sure you prepare what you're going to say so that you don't end up being some kind of loose cannon at the front of church. But there isn't time to go into all that detail because I'd really like us to focus on the whole question of how we go about picking songs and hymns for congregational use, because personally I see this as a really big deal. Many of us have been put in roles as musicians primarily because we can play an instrument or sing. We found our way suddenly to the front because of something that we do privately in our houses. And it has always worried me that there's kind of an assumption that somebody who has a nice voice or even somebody who can play a few chords on the guitar is suddenly deemed ready for leadership and responsibility, because I see little connection between the ability to play three chords on the guitar and being ready for leadership, especially if you look carefully and see where our future Prime Minister has placed the capo in relation to his hands. But it is quite probable, if you're here, that you'll find yourself regularly or occasionally in the position where you get to decide what your congregation is going to sing. How many of you are in that one? How many of you choose material? would have been so awkward now if the bulk of the seminar had been aimed at three people, but there we are. But I want to help give you a model to think that through that you may find useful. And I think there are basically three basic factors that ought to govern our choices, and they kind of work a little bit like a zoom lens method. So I suggest that perhaps you should be thinking first of all about the strategy for your specific church, and then you zoom in one notch and you think about the flow of a specific service, and then finally you zoom all the way in and look at the quality of specific songs. So you start with looking at your church and what works, and then you move into the flow of a specific service, and then you look at the quality of the song. So instead of just looking at a song and saying, oh, this is a good one, let's use it, we start with a bigger picture. And I think it's a helpful way of doing this. So let's unpack that a little bit. The strategy for your specific church. Your church is going to have its own ethos, and you should work as a musician within that ethos. And whether you're employed to do that, or whether you've arrived as a volunteer, it's a good thing to actually fit within what is happening. And sure, you can have conversations and you can stimulate discussion, but fundamentally, if you use the front of the church as a place to rebel against the flowing ethos of your church, it's going to go badly wrong. Part of that ethos is going to be about styles of music that are favoured by your congregation. But there are other issues too. The theological style of your church, the cultural style of your church, even the social context of your church, those are all big things. The gospel hall I attended as a student had a simple communion service every Sunday where there was a huge repertoire of hymns about communion, because that was the style of service they had every week. And to be honest, some of the hymns about the crucifixion that they sang would have been deemed way too gory in a lot of church sentences, in settings, because the language was very old-fashioned and it jarred. Some churches respond well to songs with very simple poetry that can be understood on the first time you see the poetry. You know, you understand what the song's about straight off, and others like their lyrics to be a little bit more flowery. There are many good and bad outworkings of both approaches, and you've got to work out what the predominant thing should be in your place, and or whether it's a blend of all of the above if you've got a whole gamut of people coming from a whole gamut of backgrounds. Here are some principles to think about as you think about the big picture of the long-term strategy for your specific church. Number one, think about the overall diet of songs. So as a starting point, I'm saying that if you're the song chooser, don't just think about one service at a time. Think long-term. Spread it out and consider that you want to give your congregation a range of things over time. So if you're going to do that, then you've got to know lots of songs. If you're in that role, it's part of your job to spend time rooting out the great from the awful and the banal from the stuff that's worthy. To take the diet thing further, beans and toast is a wonderful thing, but a cook who only knows how to make beans and toast is never going to win a Michelin star. As a song chooser, you've got a responsibility to get to know material from a wide range of sources so that you can take the best of the best rather than the adequate, just going with the output of a few key artists whose albums you have and you happen to like the work of. So there's good stuff out there from pretty much every source, but you have to go looking for it. See, I think it's really important actually to spend some of your time looking at blogs, albums, New Irish Crown Orchestra or something, YouTube links. In fact, check out the past 400 years, hymn books, relatively recent song books, Christian radio. Sign up to wearewarship.com and get a new song in your inbox every Friday. When you find something good, share it with your peers. One of the privileges of doing the job I'm doing this week here at the conference, special assembly, I keep calling it a conference, but it's a special assembly, isn't it? One of the privileges is that I've been able to look at the songs that I've been garnering together recently and actually say, you know, here, go, use. And, you know, the stuff that I've been using this week is all widely available. The song King Forevermore that we did a couple of nights, a number of people picked up on that and asked about it. It's actually, you know, you Google King Forevermore and you get everything you need very quickly. So, just, if you find something, you know, one of the great things you could do here is among yourselves, make a little network, and when you find something that's good and works in the right kind of place, send emails and share and WhatsApp groups, and you know, the technology's all there that makes it so easy to find this great song. So I think there's much more room for collaboration outside the four walls of your own church than many people ever have, and certainly within your own church, if you've got a little team of people who are trying to do things, it's good to try and bring people with you as you introduce new material, because you very often find that songs quickly become identified with one of the three bands or, you know, one particular person. Oh, it's, you know, John's on this week, it's going to be Sovereign for Us, or whatever. And that's not a great situation, because you want to try and think about the diet being influenced by everybody. And it's actually lovely when you bring a song to church and then you suddenly find that other people deliberately, intentionally choose the song. It can be a real encouragement to the person who brought it in the first place. I'm one of those people who has a strange, I don't remember what I did this morning, but I remember where I learned specific songs at specific times, just because that's important to me. And I guess, over the years, I attribute certain songs with particular memories of people who brought them. And I guess I would just say, be dynamic about how you share material, because that's a really important thing. And musicians are not always good at that, particularly when you think of just how personal writing music and sharing music is. It's because of our own personal taste, sometimes we're reticent to put forward and say, what do you think of this? But sometimes boldness pays off. Share good work. I love it when people send me good congregational worship songs, because it means they've saved me some work, and that's a good thing. Use songs then to educate your congregation. People remember lyrics more than sermons. And this gives us a big responsibility to choose decent lyrics. We're planting seeds that contribute to the way people think about God. And the culture of regular Bible reading is very different now from what it was a couple of generations ago. More and more believers are shaking in their faith, or at least willing to admit it. You've got prominent voices, Stephen Fry, Richard Dawkins, and others, loud. And I'm finding more and more of my generation are suddenly worried about the very roots of their faith, because they're shocked by what they're hearing, and the pressure in society is coming in thick and hard. Christians are less and less clear about what we actually believe. So just as we need good nutrition for a healthy diet, then we also need decent edifying material in our worship. And it might only be a small part of the battle against doubt and unbelief, but it is a genuine part that you have the potential to do a little thing to help with if you've got the song picking job. So I'm going to suggest that you should emphasise God and his character and his works and his constant and ongoing activity in our world. You should sing good theology. You should feed the church. And in so doing, because the church is the hope of the world, you change the world. And don't underestimate the power of the things you plant in people's heads. You also want to try and balance theology with emotion. If there's no theological content in the thing, then you lose the chance to teach people truth. But also, if it's all theological content with no element of personal response, then it's harder to encourage any kind of emotional engagement. To put that differently, if you only teach old and even modern hymns, your congregation will have a really strong knowledge of what God has done and what that means in a kind of intellectual sense, but they will have fewer opportunities to tell Jesus they love him. If you only teach songs which begin and end with how I feel about God today, then you're contributing to a situation where people's emotional expression is not rooted in solidity. You need material from both elements and to balance the diet. Keep a count of new songs. I reckon the average church probably can learn one song a month if they really go for it. Any more and they get a bit overloaded. Beyond that, you're really pushing it. If you look back over a year and you've added 3 to 4 songs that have actually taken off in your church and been used, then I think you've done really well. If you see people quoting those songs in their social media statuses and other people pick them when you're not leading, then well done, those are good signs. If you haven't learned anything new at all in a period of 6 months, maybe it's time to rethink that and expand the horizons a little. Additionally, I would suggest that it's really important to teach songs over a period of a few weeks rather than just at one service. So to engage well with a song, you tend to find that you need to take your time, particularly because so many songs now have so many sections. You've got the verse and the tag and the chorus and the bridge. And it's a lot for people to grasp. If a song is worth learning, however, it's worth doing it more than once, whether you decide that it is repertoire or rubbish. And sometimes, after one shot, somebody will say something discouraging to you, and you think, nah, it's not going to work. And you then discard something that actually could have worked. I did that with Cornerstone, which turned out to be a huge song. Last night we sat, the first time I heard Cornerstone, the first time I heard it, you know the bit where on the recording it goes, my anchor holds within the mouth, my anchor holds within the mouth, the octave, okay? And I was put off by that. I thought, this can't work congregationally. And it was just a case of adjusting the key and put it in the right place. And then once we found the right key for it, it didn't do the octave leap, it made sense. And sometimes you need to do little things like that for it to work in your setting and your time. But what I'll say to you is that there's been many times when I've looked at a song and not persisted with it when actually it turned out that the song was one I revisited later. And so looking at songs over time is a useful way of teaching the church. So if you do them 1 week, then do them again. And if after 3 weeks it still feels like you're pushing a tank up a hill, I think it's over at that point. You've got to be honest about that. And in some places, I mean, I had a conversation a couple of years ago with the song Oceans with two people, both from churches that are loosely charismatic, both members of Biharj, and one was saying, I think Oceans is the best song we've had for many years. The other was saying, it's a terrible congregational song. And I would never have predicted that those two churches would have seen that so differently, but actually they both tried it, and one had adopted it fully, the other had totally given it up. So you can't legislate for how it's going to pan out in your place, because the actual atmosphere in the room is often conducive to whether or not a song picks up. Now, having said that, there's still room for you to pick a song and push it through because you think this is a theologically worthy song with a melody that works, but it all has to come together for people to want to sing the song and engage with it naturally. And that's why it's important that people who are theologians write hymns as well and actually put forward that whole culture. The other thing you need to do is you need to engage the whole demographic of your church. This is Gladys, and not everybody is like Gladys. It says there under the picture, if you can't see it. After 50 years as the church organist, Gladys made a genuine effort to adjust to the new worship format. Let's try and create a situation where our older brothers and sisters are not alarmed or alienated. And actually, that's easier than we might think. Using the best of the material from the last few hundred years rather than confining ourselves to stuff from the last five is a good start. Often it's the songs that are between 10 and 40 years old that get neglected, and they still have a lot more to offer than we might realise. They haven't reached the legendary status of "And Cannot Be" or "Crowned with Many Crowns," but they still hold value. Songs like Graham Kendrick's "The Servant King," or "Great is the Lord and Most Worthy of Praise," "All Heaven declares the Glory of the Risen Lord." And then some amazing lyrics in some of the older Victorian hymns. I bet not many of you are going to Victorian hymns when you're looking for new material for your congregation. But actually, I rediscovered something about them recently, in the last few years, which is that some of the poetry may be heavily sentimental, but as a statement about intimacy with God, it's achingly beautiful. And I'm going to give you a hymn which I have forgotten about for years and years, two verses of it. It's a hymn called "Love with Everlasting Love." Second line, "Led by grace that love to know, Spirit breathing from above, you have taught me it is so. Oh, this full and perfect peace. Oh, this presence, all divine, depending on the timbre you have. In a love that cannot cease, I am his and he is mine." But then the next verse goes, "Heaven above is softer blue, earth around is sweeter green." And it starts to analyse creation and say, you know, it's all nicer because I'm yours. And it's expressed in very simple, easily understandable poetry. But actually, it's quite powerful in its own way. And I think what I found really striking about it when I rediscovered the hymn was the fact that suddenly there was an antidote to the idea that you had to sing songs of a particular style if you were going to go for something that was emotionally connected. So there was in these old hymns a way of expressing, you know, a hymn like "It Is Well With My Soul," that's almost a crown of many crowns to us. But when you have an understanding of the story behind it and, you know, the loss that was experienced by the writer, and then the whole idea that when you assert those words, you're expressing something visceral, aren't you? It's not just something that's theological. Now, I sing theology, I love to sing theology. "King Forevermore" is a big theological statement. But it's about the balance that allows people to bring their whole selves to the praise of God. And if you simply sing the stuff that is telling us again about things that we already know without allowing any kind of response, then it's only part of the picture. And I would encourage you to think broadly about where you might find songs in unexpected places that might be helpful. I now need to plug this in because my iPad is threatening to go off. One second. Oh, good. Okay, so let's move away from the expectation that if you're going to bring a new song to the church, it has to be always brand new out of the box. And from experience, let me encourage you that in order to keep the elderly people on side, you actually don't have to do old stuff all that often. It's the odd, carefully chosen song that maybe has a bit of nostalgia in it like that, every now and again, and it breathes a little bit of life. You know, if you think, rethink the music of whatever, so slightly, just strip down the chords a little bit more. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But that sort of thing can go a long way towards mutual respect and tolerance in a church, particularly when you have a change in culture in this area that has divided so many people over the years. The other thing is to try and reflect the true breadth of Christian experience, human experience, sorry. We are not happy all the time, far from it. We need songs that help us to mourn, to repent, to express faith in the midst of doubt, as well as the songs to dance and be joyful. Be mindful as you choose that not everybody is in the same emotional state that you're in right now. So that's the strategy for your specific church. Then you want to be spending some time thinking, zoom in one notch, the flow of the specific service. What's happening this particular day? So once you come away from the big strategic picture of building a diet of good material for your church to sing, you then zoom in and you find out what's going on in the service. Different churches are going to have different expectations here. I quite like the idea of using a song to start which either directly praises God or invites people as a call to worship to do so. Praise the Lord the Almighty. Praise is rising, eyes are turning to you. Come thy fount of every blessing. 10,000 reasons, that sort of thing. I think that sets a good tone for the start of when we meet together. Often it's something that's related to the theme of the service, but sometimes it's more generic. But that's just the particular way in which we tend to operate. And I'd suggest that there might be two principles that help you when you're looking at how to shape the choice of songs in the service. And the first is this: get into the Bible. If you can get the preacher to tell you the passage he or she is working from, then please do it. Read it. Pray through it and see where the Holy Spirit takes you. What songs come to your mind as a person who's interested enough in songs to be in worship as you read that passage? If you can remember one line of a song as you read, you know, go to your Googling machine and put that one line in, and then you'll find that you'll find the whole song quickly and work out, yeah, the flow of that. Gosh. Because you do find there are writers who actually do use the Bible in their writing. The other thing, as a balancing thing to that, is that you've also got to keep an eye on the energy in the room. And this is about making sure that you don't end up picking songs where you end up with a beautifully crafted thematic service that only contains slow songs with 6 verses in them, or perhaps just fast songs at 4-4 at 120 beats a minute, you know, where everything is exactly the same, because chances are they'll all have the same chord sequence as well. And it might sound like a cynical thing to say, but you've got to structure your service by something other than just the content of the lyrics, because actually you do need to be aware of the imperfections of human beings and understand that a little bit of light and shade in the flow of their experience as they sit there in the congregation trying to engage is needed for our attention to be sustained and the emotional highs and lows to be experienced during service. When I'm at my best and I have time, I take time, let's be honest, I'm prioritising. I find that the best thing to do is actually to do the thing where you get into the Bible, analyse the passage, be quiet for a while, see what comes into your head, ask the Spirit to help, in the hope that you get a list of about 10 songs from which to choose the 5 or 6 you're going to end up doing. And then you've got all the stuff that's, you know, you've got all the possible options on the menu for that particular theme. But actually you can then get a flow going through the thing. And I think sometimes in our desire to just get the job done, we go too quickly. And we go, oh right, that fits, that's done. And I think that's not the best way of fostering good habits and diet. So if you've got that responsibility, then I think it's worth really being careful about that. So then the third thing in the zoom-in lens is about the quality of specific songs. We've come from the big strategic plan through the thoughts about an individual service and then into the detail. And I have a few suggestions for you in this area. First of all, be ruthless with the lyrics. If a song has a phenomenal groove and a really hooky tune, but the lyrics read like a bunch of self-centered cliches that might have been assembled by a computer program, then you should look elsewhere. I don't like criticising people's songs, and over the years I'm aware myself that I have personally written some horrendous rubbish as part of my own life learning curve. And I'm going to try and keep directly critical comment to a minimum, but I'm going to give you a couple of examples of things that may not be great. Sing good content. There's a big trend at the moment in a lot of the published music. At the point in the song where you get to what might have been the chorus or the joints between the various verses, to use the word whoa for a long time. And I think there's a place for that sort of thing in performance music, but I question its value in congregational singing, especially in the light of the value system we're trying to talk about, where you're actually using congregational singing as a way of educating people about theology and allowing them to express things that are deeper than whoa. If songs are dominated by lyrics like whoa, there's not a huge amount of value in them. Partly because the whoa moment tends to be the point when people are most carried away, because it usually occurs in the musical climax of the song as well. So sing truth. It's okay to use metaphor. Years ago people used to talk about the song, "These are the days of Elijah." We were not. Of course, Robin was painting a picture there of days of opportunity and redemption by referencing the Old Testament prophets who urged people to turn to God. I have a bigger difficulty with songs that are just not true. Songs that talk about coming into the presence of God as though God's presence is not something which is real and personal all the time. We need to be careful that our songs paint a picture of the consistency of God and his behaviour in a manner that's totally compatible with Scripture. We've also got to run the cultural filter. We need to be careful. It's obvious now that the stereotypical and sometimes, in some cases, downright racist lyrics of some of the kids' songs of the past have no real place in modern society. The first of those two examples was sung in my Sunday school in the 1970s. "Jesus loves the Indian boy, bow and arrow for his toil. He loves the cowboy too, with the horse and big suit." The second was done with horrendous corresponding actions in my mother's Sunday school in the 1950s. And she still taught it to my children. But those are extremes. We've also got to be aware that some words might have the potential to make people giggle, because they're too far from the theological words that we use. I once was playing the piano during the hymn, "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing," which I love. And we hadn't said anything in advance about any of the lyrics in the hymn. It was just like, "Come on, let's worship. Here we go." And when it got to the line, "Here I raise my Ebenezer," there was a girl 2 rows behind me who suddenly started to hear this, like this. And I was just like, okay. And she'd sensed some sort of weird double entendre there. Now, she was not a mature Christian, but she was in our church that morning. And I'm going to suggest to you that if you're going to use lines that are perhaps linguistically difficult for people, you've got to go from the start and think, is this wise? And some people say it's a wonderful thing. You explain the word. You know, you take it, you be proactive about it. I went proactive in a different way. I rehashed the 4 verses of "Come, I find a new blessing," and chopped the enemies or line out. So the hymn still says essentially the same thing. And I didn't write any new lyrics either. I just took bits of that verse and bits of that verse. It's my 3-verse hymn on my computer. But it means I have a version that's Ebenezer-free. There are also many songs which talk about intimacy with God in a way which, when you're in a mixed audience of people who believe and people who do not believe and people who are confused and all sorts of things, and with all sorts of difficulties in their lives as well, we can sometimes sing about intimacy with God in a way that sounds surprisingly sexual to uninitiated ears. "Your mind is our, no one else will do, nothing else will take your place, to feel the warmth of your embrace." Those words occur in a song that's been widely sung, which doesn't actually mention God. The whole tone is slightly awkwardly romantic to my ear. I don't doubt the integrity of the writer for a moment, nor would I be against the idea of singing that song as part of my own personal devotions. But I personally wouldn't use that in a public worship service, because I can see how it might jar with people. Equally problematic are the hymns from the past, where the language is so far away from modern English as to be culturally alienating. And now I realise that I'm about to do this, "The Potentate of Time," which was in one of the songs we did here this week in quite many crowds. Potentate, not everybody knows what a potentate is. But actually, it's worth taking the time to explain the more powerful God. "Visions of rapture now burst in my sight. I have never worked out what that line is." There's a fair bit of thinking for your average Jew to do to be able to get the flow of the meaning, and we've got to be sensitive to that. And I got wrong myself occasionally. I was in a steak restaurant some time ago and I learnt there that searing means burning. I had always assumed that searing actually meant tearing, ripping apart, how great the pain of searing loss I thought was about being, was the son being ripped apart from his place to the father. No, it was burning loss. And I had a totally unclear picture in my mind. Not particularly important in terms of my understanding of how deep the father's love for us, but actually, it could have been. And so it's important to be clear about vocabulary. Always be aware of how the outsider is going to read a lyric, and then try to choose things that are logical, coherent, true, and if possible, also half decent artistic poetry that are actually going to be, you know, that draws you in. One of the hardest things is to find a song which is high in energy and also full of good theology. We're going to do When I Was Lost, You Came and Rescued Me Tonight, which is a big statement of God's redemption. It's one of my favourite examples of the song which is energetic, but at the same time also theological. But those are few and far between. If you ever find any, please just email me, jonathan@theirishhouse.com. I want to know about it. Bottom line, if you've got some sort of doubt in your mind about a lyric, it is worth being rigorous about that. Step back. Distance yourself from the fact that we know the vocabulary and think about how other people perceive it. I recommend that rather than running with the Judas lyric, you simply just go and choose something better from your list of 10. There's tons of material without having to resort to awkward moments. Then you want to be selective with tunes. As a rule of thumb, I always say to people, can you sing the tune in the car on the way home without any musical accompaniment? If it's been done in your church a couple of times. If you find that it needs to have all the rhythm of the band behind it for it to make any sense musically at all, then it probably isn't an ideal congregational song. Keith Getty talks a lot of this. He says he wants the church to get a resource of melodies which are not just singable, not just that they work, but that they are great to sing. We need stuff that's in the right octave for people to sing, the right key. We need even rhythms. But we also want things that are artistically satisfying, because the Lord is worthy of our best. And I honestly believe there is enough material in hundreds of years of hymns and new songs being written for us to have the room to be properly selective. I spend, usually somewhere in the late spring, I will spend 3 or 4 days wading through songs. And the driver for it is the summer. Because the summer, sometimes I get to do things like this week, New Horizon, other conferences like that. But we also have our New Irish Youth Choir. And I'm asking myself, what songs do I want the New Irish Youth Choir to know by the end of the summer? And it's a painful process which always involves paracetamol. Because in order to get to the point where I find the gold, I've got to wade through a whole lot of stuff that switches me off very quickly. Because everybody can self-publish now. And so, you know, people who can't write poetry do it anyway and put it on the internet, and it's as easy to find it as it is to find some of the great things. And then there are songs that rise to the top of the CCLI chart. And you think, hark! And so you've got to be discerning in these things. And that takes time. And if you've got that role in your church, can I just remind you again, you're putting the stuff into the heads that people are actually going to be able to regurgitate fully. Every parent of a primary school child has heard and knows the words of the songs from Frozen. But most of us would struggle to re-articulate the sermon we heard 2 weeks ago. Now, I am not devaluing sermons. The place for Bible teaching is huge, and I have full respect, but as a complement to the Bible teaching, what you're giving people is a way of taking it home. And that's why it's worth trying to work together with the person who's doing the preaching, so that what you do actually formulates something that is more memorable for people, that they take home and actually it becomes part of their life and their work of life every day. So that when they're standing waiting for the bus, going along in the car in the traffic jam, and they start to hum, and the lyrics come back with that, and the concept comes with it. Be aware of things that are trendy. I like that picture. Irving Berlin, who wrote White Christmas and Alexander's Ragtime Band, somewhere in and around the turn of the 20th century, said a lovely sentence, which I just think is funny because it's so obvious. Popular music is popular because many people like it. Just because stuff is popular doesn't mean to say it's good. If a song doesn't stand up to a proper examination of lyrics and melody, it can still hit the top of the chart. And that's true, especially when the songs are brilliant performance songs, where the main problem actually is going to be the vocal range, you know, the range of notes that you need in order to be able to access the song. And it's often a mistake to try and incorporate an uncongregational song like melody into congregational worship. And so we've got to be careful to make sure that our congregation will actually have the capability to sing. Ask yourself when you find a song, what is it about this song that's drawing me in? Why do I like it? If you can see that the song has good content, a great congregationally singable tune, and some sort of aesthetic or artistic appeal to it, then great, use away. Try it a couple of them, see how it works. And then when somebody comes after the service and says, I knew when you did the day was desperate, what were you thinking of? You can tell them. But if all you've done is buy an album and go, oh, track two, then you get nowhere to go, because actually you haven't thought the process through. Because if they say, that's not singing by the congregation, even if you thought about it and got the wrong answer, you can say, do you know what, I thought about it, I wasn't sure about that. But I thought it probably would work, but I think you might be right. Or give us another week with it and see how it goes. You know, work with people in those situations and try and give them a credibility when they come and challenge your decision. But you have to do the thinking in advance in order to feel secure at that moment when somebody challenges what you've just done. Hopefully you'll phrase the answer graciously enough. You still have a friend at the end of it. Bottom line, to get good songs, consider the Zoom lens method, strategy for your church, the flow for the service, and the quality of specific songs. Okay. Is there anything anybody wants to say, ask, or whatever, to do with choosing songs for church? When I have longer with people, and I do the thing, do an interactive thing, it's a point where people are given an exercise to go and look at a passage and try and choose some songs with a brief. We're not going to do that now because it's 10 to 5, and I want to cover a couple of other things as well. How many of you are involved at any level in the organisation of a rehearsal of some sort in church for people who are together putting a service together? Enough to do this, but let's do it. Okay. Here's the sort of band practice I'm talking about. 10 o'clock, the practice starts. 10:04, the caretaker arrives to open the church building. The band leader and the three most righteous band members have been grumbling out in the cold go inside. 10:09, the whole band are nearly there, but the guitarist hasn't arrived yet, so you phone the guitarist and he's still in his pyjamas. In fact, he's actually in bed, but he'll be there in a minute. 10:11, the sound guy arrives, a big cheery smile, and asks why he hasn't started yet. He turns on the PA system and loses the cheery smile immediately because there was a concert in the church the night before and all the settings have been changed. Everything's swapped around, the cables are all lost, and he doesn't know what to do. He says a naughty word, which is only partially audible from the front. 10:13. Why are there now two bass players this morning? One of them slams the door, leaves in a huff because he read the rota wrongly. 10:14. The clock mysteriously changes to a different piece of clip art. And then the sax player realises that her only reed is broken. The remaining bass player realises his only lead is broken. And the band leader realises her spirit is broken. 10:18, the guitarist arrives and he congratulates, didn't I do well? I got all the way from my bed to here in 9 minutes. The flute player, who is due to sit beside him, prays silently that by some divine miracle he's managed to wash his armpits in the meantime. 10:23, the first song gets practiced. It's new, but only one person listened to the MP3 that was sent out in advance. 10:34, the new song is abandoned because we can't get the groove right. The band leader changes the song and tells the easy worship person who tuts it in a disapproving manner. 10:40, it's suddenly going really well. Church is filling up lightly. The band are really pleased with their new blues version of How Great Thou Art. Oh, it's going to be an awesome service. The band are locked in together. And the congregation is just going to be blown away by the presence of it all. 10:56, there are still three songs to practice. We all got to be a bit carried away with the blues guitar solo between verses 2 and 3 of How Great Thou Art. The band leader calls the group together in a huddle, which to the congregation looks like they're praying, but it's actually just a team talk to make sure they know how many verses are in the remaining songs and what key they're in. The guitar player mutters something about really wanting a cup of tea and he wishes he'd had breakfast before he came. 10:58, the band leader, who's now stressed, the whole visit to the bathroom to gather her thoughts and have a quick cry about what's just been happening. And then she gets up to lead the first song, but as she's on her way at 11 o'clock precisely, the minister gets up to do the official ministerial welcome without her first jacket she's in place, so the poor girl ends up legging it down the aisle in a completely ungainly manner to get to the piano in time for when he stops talking. And in between her puffing and panting, she manages to put on a fake smile and tell the congregation how great it is to draw aside from all the strains and stresses of the week and spend some reflective time together worshipping the presence of the Lord. I didn't make up a single thing in that. Now, it's like the typical day. It didn't all happen in one day, but it has all happened in my company, every single thing, including the bass player standing in the door, and it was actually kind of funny. Worse still, there have been times when I've been the perpetrator of some of it. We're never perfect. I'm not proud of my own consistency and brilliant timekeeping. I started this seminar for nothing. So these are the things we all need to make a great effort. But there are some things that might help when we practice together. The first is some kind of realistic time commitment. You've got to be sensible about this. People are busy. And there's a balance to be struck between saying you need to commit and then becoming a burden to God's servants. One of the historical problems associated with traditional church choirs was the whole idea that Sarah Soprano or Tommy Tenor was asked to help them with something else in church life, and they were like, ah, oh, I do the choir. Their time was gone. And they could legitimately claim that that was their act of service to the church. The trouble was that in many cases, the choir's contribution to church life wasn't doing a huge amount to advance God's kingdom. And so you've got to be careful with the level of time demand you expect from people and how you deploy the amount of time they've got available in the big picture of what church life is. So that they've room in their lives for serving God with other aspects of their gifting that might have a more direct kingdom input in people's lives than their professional trumpet playing or their tenor singing. So I think that for a normal service, a 1 hour practice is a perfectly reasonable expectation. And if it's more complicated than that and takes longer, then it may mean that it's overly complicated. Sometimes there's merit in getting people together for a longer stint, maybe to learn 3 new songs at one go, or just to practice jamming together to get better. But you shouldn't need hours on end every week if you can do the planning properly. You also want to do everything you can to try and help everybody in the group to have a good attitude. And you can engender good attitudes and really help things if you've been reasonably organised yourself. You want people to arrive on time with their servant hats on, to bring their spare reeds, their extra leads, the sheet music they need, and the pencil they're going to need. And I think the best way to help good attitudes is to form good relationships with people, actually, and then be direct about your expectations. Be upfront. Get to know the people that you lead in your group. And then you earn the right to ask them to bring a pencil every week. You've also, of course, got to be organised yourself. Have the right stuff with you. There's a situation where I'm aware of where the leader of an organisation doesn't have a clue how to organise themselves. And the person's team is diminishing and diminishing and diminishing. Of course it is. Because people find the chaos too hard to tolerate. We can't all be perfect all the time, but a wee bit of basic planning should mean that we have the correct things with us. I will tell you that in the New Irish Choir and Orchestra, we bring a box of pencils to every rehearsal. Because we know, fine rightly, that a huge number of people don't bring pencils. It's mad that that's the case. But the quick fix is to own a box of pencils. A wee bag containing a couple of guitar leads somewhere in your church, a few plectrum, all the necessary sheet music for yourself, maybe a couple of spares for other people. And I find that the little bit of extra time when you take the trouble to do things that way pays dividends, because it comes across as though you're taking the job seriously, and it removes some of the difficulties from some of the disorganized people that we tolerate. When I arrive and half the stuff's in my own house, I look like I don't care, and that's no use. Let's also have instruments that are in tune in our rehearsals. It's really practical. Why not, as a church, buy a few guitar tuners and have them sitting around with a supply in the cupboard somewhere of relevant batteries, so that you don't have that awful thing where the guitar starts to say, ouch, you know? Those remove arguments as well, which is good. You also need an explicit plan for a rehearsal. Decide what you want to achieve in practice before you leave the house. Have a clear idea of what you want to do with each song. And then you can lead with confidence and tell people what the plan is. Most people respond as musicians very well to clear instructions. We're going to do 3 verses, but in between the third and the fourth, in the second and third, we're going to do X, whatever. So you've got to pick songs that are within the capability of your church Tell the group why you've chosen them. Let them understand the spiritual stuff that's gone into the planning for the day, rather than just the crotchets and the quivers. And then think about some sort of sensible running order for the rehearsal. I like to start every rehearsal with something that's straightforward, something that's just going to work. What Pete Comfort, our drummer here this week, calls a chicken dinner of a song. So King of Kings, Majesty is a chicken dinner, and Christ Alone is a chicken dinner, something that just works. And then you're thinking, not so much about can I play this song, but does the band, can I hear what I need to hear? Is this what, you know, is it working? Okay? And once you've done your chicken dinner, then you take on the most challenging thing that you're going to try in the rehearsal. So if there's a new song, that's the point to do it. And then anything that you want to do a little differently from usual, and then you can relax towards the end and become progressively easier, which is a very obvious thing about how the energy runs out in the group as you get towards the end of the rehearsal. The thing about that is that that's just managing people's time in a way, and it means then that when you get the easy stuff at the end, there's a chance that you won't get everything done in 1 hour practice before the service, but it's, you know, if the last song you haven't rehearsed is 10,000 Reasons and you've played it 14 times already in that year as a band, then it's not an absolutely major issue if you don't get to it, because you'll be okay. But you'll have taken the time you need on the thing you're trying to do that's maybe a little different that day. You've also got to be sensitive as a leader. In church, it's vital that we don't behave like dictators. There's a lot of this that goes on in the professional world, you know. Conductors who get really, really defensive and hate it when the musicianship is challenged. They don't respond with good humour when made an honest mistake. And somebody put, you know, it's a thing in professional music. The conductor is a dictator. And I think it's important to remember when we're in church that we're all fallible. And humility in church leadership, I think, is much more important than authority. By all means, establish a dynamic where you can lead effectively. But often you'll do that better if you're not rude or insecure or insensitive or bullshit. So, apologise when you make a mistake. Smile at the person who helped you to find the error. Try it anyway. Ditch things that you plan but which aren't working. A couple of years ago at New Horizon, I picked a song that I thought was a winner. It was a new Stuart Townend song called Promise of the Ages. Do you know the song Promise of the Ages? Interesting. Because you know most of Stuart Townend songs, don't you? I thought Promise of the Ages was a winner. And I told the group this once, and there was somebody who really still did think it was a winner. It obviously worked well in his church. But we worked on it in the band. We worked on it for a wee while. Still didn't feel right. And after about half an hour of trying to make this song, I don't just play. It felt like we were wrestling rather than playing it. And in the end, I had to let it go. It was a good lyric, but musically it just wasn't coming together with a group of very fine musicians. Sometimes you've got to ditch the things that aren't working. You know the song By Faith by the Geddes? By faith we see the other hand of God. In verse 5 of that song, in Keith and Krista's recording, there's a moment where it goes, by faith this mountain shall be moved, and by faith, and the power of the gospel will prevail. Now, if you try and get a 15-year-old drummer to play that, when the drummer has only ever played, then they're not going to get the in the right place without quite a lot of preparation. I know this because I tried for a good 5 to 7 minutes on that one thing with one guy one day who really wanted to do it. But in the end, it was a total and utter waste of time because it wasn't happening that day. Maybe it was something we could have done on a Friday evening rehearsal sometime, or, you know, a longer period of time. But that morning, I was not going to serve our congregation better if we got the dun-dun-dun right, because there was a 75% chance he was going to not be on it. So what we did instead was, I'll demonstrate properly. You know, the piano on the album goes, by faith this mountain shall be moved. And that's what happens in the morning. So instead we went, by faith this mountain shall be moved. And the power of, and it worked perfectly well, and the congregation were none the wiser that we had wasted 10 minutes of our time trying to work out what the solution was going to be. Simplification is almost always a good thing. It was simpler, gave a clearer lead. No one doubted where we were in the song, what beat we were in the bar, just worked far better. Another thing, however, I maybe did it with that drummer that day, but he was just so desperate to get it right, it was a pity. Avoid singling people out. There's a tendency in some quarters to put massive spotlight on people in rehearsals. I'm talking more on the secular world, but I still remember the P4 teacher in my school who went along the front row of the choir in 3 years, checking who it was that wasn't singing in tune so that they could be eliminated. Every other kid in the room knew who it was by the end of the period, you know. We need to avoid putting pressure on people where possible. And if a thing needs to be rehearsed again and again and again and again by one individual, then probably the idea is just too complex. Move on. Do something simple. We need to affirm and encourage. Once when New Irish was recording a CD, I went into the little control room to have a listen to the result of what we'd just been doing for the last little while. And I came out of the room to tell the choir that we're going to have to do it again. And instead of saying something nice or anything nice, I just said the words, "Not everything about it is bad." And it rolled off my tongue, and I realised, well, I didn't have to realise, because the collective groan, I had spent a huge amount of their goodwill and energy in that one sentence. It was a mistake. It wasn't the most encouraging noise I've ever made. It's good to affirm the stuff that's good. That was great from the point of view of rhythm, but the tuning, just a little moment there, I need to fix that again. That would have been a better way to do that. It's also good to pray. Maybe if we pray more during our practices, or even before we leave the house to go to practice, we might see a difference in how things pan out. Those are all things I think will help. If you can get those ducks lined up in a row, you should find rehearsals that are reasonably productive, even if you're working with limited time availability. I'm going to talk briefly about arrangements. Sometimes in a rehearsal, things get needlessly complex. Somebody comes up with a suggestion, and before you know it, the team have persuaded themselves that it's a great idea to do the thing I mentioned a few minutes ago, a blues version of How Great Thou Art. So instead of the standard thing, you end up with a sort of, I don't know which notes this thing worked, but it's not very nice. It hasn't had a lot of love. Probably, it started out as a nice piano, but it's no longer one. But you end up with, "Oh Lord, my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all..." And then you can hear how a band might land on something that's a little bit left of field like that. And sometimes you think, "That's cool." That doesn't really do the idea justice. It's actually not a bad idea, but don't do it. Because if you carry it into the service, it's going to have an effect on the congregation. Because during the song, people will listen to it, and some will say it's cool. Some will maybe come up the aisle and say, "That's good." "How great they are. Who would have thought you could have done that to that? That was anointed." At the same time as that's happening, somebody else is in their car going, "What on earth were they thinking?" Classic great hymn is completely ruined. What a disgrace. And all that's been achieved in that is that everybody's talking about music. And the whole focus of the hymn, which is supposed to be the greatness of God, has been totally compromised. And it has happened because of the self-indulgent musical whim on the part of a band who were out for a bit of a laugh, really. Every musical decision we make should be about serving your congregation and helping them sing. And that's why I have to draw a line in the sand between the work I do with New Irish Arts, the luxury Tesco finest music, if you like, which is designed to be presented by a bunch of accomplished musicians, and local church music, which is all about facilitating a motley crew, a worshipping congregation of non-professional singers who are there to assert their identity together as God's people. In both of those areas in my life, actually, as it happens, the songs are fundamentally designed to point people to God. There's a clear difference in the context in which they're used. So when you think about church-based arrangements, I want you to think about a number of different things. The first is that you want them to be simple and supportive. Remember, it's all about facilitating the congregation. Talk about them being the worshipping team. Everybody's part of the worshipping team, therefore it should be straightforward. People should know when to come in. Clear needs. It should be more about that than about us showing off. Then you need to know where the artists are. People complain about this all the time. We got to the end of the verse and I didn't know where it was. Sometimes it could be wrong. I messed this up once very publicly in the New Horizon tent with 3,000 people, where we were doing the song Praises Right. And the intro for that can be done either as a 4-bar or an 8-bar thing. It's just the arrangement that we have simply grooves on the open G chord. Approximately 500 people out of the 3,000 of them. And I didn't do anything. But half the orchestra then decided they would go with the congregation. And I'm left, no, 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 you want to go. And the only way to redeem the situation was leaning the mic. 1, 2, 3, 4, praise! Which is what I actually did. And I was mortified, it was horrible. And I went, before we used the arrangement again, and deleted 4 bars from it, because it was, I should explain, we have arrangements that are performed arrangements that are for when we do concerts, and then we have a big folder called New Irish Congregation of stuff that's supposed to be the chicken dinner, if you like. Stuff that just works. So the stuff we've been using this week should all be chicken dinners. And if there's anything complicated, we'll look at each other and, you know, about, so Strength Will Rise, which we did last night, there's a version of that that we have where the intro goes on a little longer than it ought to, and we simplified it for last night and ditched a 2-bar little bit where it kind of hangs along, which when we're doing the concert, we'll do that. And it's all about making it accessible for you as you sing as a congregation. And one of the encouragements of this week actually has been the noise of the congregational singing. And that's because we actually really believe in that. It's a really powerful thing when people are singing together. You also need an appropriate key. People's voices have fallen in recent years, you know. This is an actual scientific thing. In the old days, if you lived in an old hymn book, the hymn I always remember with this is the hymn Up From the Grave He Arose. Rumpy tum thing, isn't it? But in the old hymn books, that was in C major, which meant it started on G, and down on the C, and then up to the top of that. But he arose, in fact, he arose, all the way up there. That was right. Hallelujah. And if you try and sing a top F for congregation, now it's not pretty, because congregations don't sing top Fs anymore. Most of the stuff that's produced now in Christ and normally published in either D major, therefore down to the A, so you can go that little bit lower than what they would have done in the Redemption hymn book that I learned Pierre Rose in. But it'll only end up in the D at the top, or if it's an E flat, it'll go from the B flat up to the E flat. So you're talking about a much more confined range, and it's just the centre of gravity is a little lower than it used to be. Most old hymn books would have had nothing below middle C. You look at a hymn book now that's well produced for congregational singing, and you'll find that everything is, you know, you're touching the B flats and the A's all the time. And it's just because people's voices are different from where they were a couple of generations ago. One of the reasons, apparently, is because people are eating a healthy diet that makes them grow faster. And then they get bigger, and lower notes, I don't know. That's what I've been told. There's also a diminishing culture of singing in schools, and so the voice doesn't develop its range as much as in classroom singing rather than choral singing. You know, it becomes more of a league thing in schools now than it used to be when there were no resources and the kids had to sing. So it's annoying that so many songs are published in keys that are perfect for the boy band who originally recorded them. There are Christian publishing companies who published the song in the same key as Matt Redman, but Matt Redman's voice is really high. Ren Clacton's ranges of songs are huge. 10,000 Reasons, the first time I saw it, was in G major. Work with me. There's your first note. Bless the Lord, my soul. Musicnotes.com has a lot of songs available in transposable versions. PraiseCharts.com also has lots of songs available in transposable versions. Or you can buy a keyboard with a button on it that will do it for you if you're dealing with very limited resources. But whatever you do, don't just ignore that issue, because if you do, you're removing yourself from the possible use of a whole wealth of material that could be effectively used. And the problem is that it's absolutely key to make a song singable, to keep your congregation engaged. The song has to fit the average Joe's vocal range for them to be relaxed and sing it confidently and think about the words instead of trying to work out when they're next going to have to drop up or down the octave for it to work. You also want to choose an appropriate speed. Can you sing all the words easily? There's a song called Sing to the Lord, Give Thanks for His Goodness. Do you know this song? By Lou Fellingham. It's a great song, lots of lyrics. It fits that lovely thing of a decent theological thing, but it's still up-tempo. But congregationally, it's kind of difficult because there's a verse which goes, His mercy is new today, abounding in every way to all He has made. So far, so good. But the next verse that says, The Spirit's available, He'll help us prevail through all that life throws our way, which might as well be red glory, yellow glory, because it's really difficult to sing that. But I can only do it because I practiced. Sometimes you can actually give a song more energy by going a little slower and heavier, especially songs that are in compound time, like Sea What a Morning or Across the Lands. When Sea What a Morning came out at first, I remember being in a sermon one morning where obviously the person playing the piano decided that the way forward to give it energy was to go faster. Right? Because people want energy in the song, it's about the resurrection. And in fact, the exact opposite needed to be done. So what we got was, when what it needs, in fact, is a big fat white beat. See what a morning, gloriously bright, with the dawning of hope. Piano for sale. you understand what I'm saying? Sometimes slower actually helps the thing. King of Kings Majesty works much, much better as a slow song than it does, sped up even 8 to 10 BPM. So, it's worth thinking about that when you choose the tempo for a song. The other thing to think about is the large-scale direction of a song. When you're doing an arrangement or you're responsible for what a band is going to play well, when, then sometimes people make the mistake of thinking the whole band has to play the whole song, and that's not so. It's far better to deploy your band gradually and give the song some shape so that it builds to the right place dynamically. And it doesn't always mean that the last verse should be the massive one. You know, there's this, of course, the cliche way of doing it. You know, verse 3, you drop everything out, and verse 4, you do everything. But you've got to think about some sort of shape that's sensitive to the lyrics. The other issue is that if you don't think about that, you can easily end up in a make-it-up-where-you-go-along situation where a lot of your band is going to get mixed up and the whole structure of the song gets compromised. And people think that that signal, a double bar line, which is supposed to be the end of the song, is actually that signal, which means just keep repeating forever. And I have no issue with repeating, but sometimes it happens all the time as part of a church's normal formula. It becomes wearisome. Sometimes a short song that's sung only once can actually be a really effective thing. Shout to the Lord, all the earth, let us sing Him our way. A song that, particularly things that are revisited from a wee while ago, and you sing it once, and it's just, and then you stop. And the song has made its point, and you move on with the big flow of what you're planning for that specific service that day. The other thing is to think about groove. Groove is basically the rhythmic framework on which the music sits. So that whole thing I was doing there with Sing in the Morning, and establishing the that is the groove, that pulse, if you like, on which it sits, and how the pulse moves around in a kind of lazy way, I suppose, in that one. That's the groove, and every song has a groove. If you're just thinking about the melody notes and about the actual rhythms that are printed in crotchets and quavers on your groove, it will not have a groove. You've actually got to have somebody there, and that's why I'm so grateful to God every day for Pete Comfort, who drums with that band, and Mark Johnson, who plays bass with him, because they create the structure on which I can play in a way that is free, because they are both proper groover musicians. I'm a classically trained piano player. Classical musicians are never trained how to groove. Those guys have been thinking like drummers, and if you have a good drummer, it's a real blessing actually. If you don't have a good drummer, get them to copy lots of different grooves. Take songs. Go and find a song that's like the way you want to do the song and say, here, listen to that, try something like that. Because an awful lot of drummers find that I have never learned to talk drum. But very often I will reference something as a model from a different song, and suddenly a song will start to make sense. When you do your arrangement, think about foreground, middle ground, and background. What's the most important thing going on here? What is the most important thing going on when you've got your worship band happening? In most cases. Which parts of the music? You've got your harmonies, your melodies, your orchestral sound, if you've got a few violins and things like that, not about the place, your drummer, your pianist. What way up does it sit? It's an actual question. Mm. Okay, so most of the time, the most important thing is that they've got a clearly written melody. Mm. So usually that comes from the vocalist. If you haven't got a good vocalist, then maybe the pianist is playing some melody, or you've got a melody instrument in that, but the melody is what they catch on to. The congregation is confident about the song, and the melody can be less important in terms of the problems it has, because then it sits in the groove, and the groove then becomes the main sound that's built up. So when you're allocating instruments, it's quite funny actually, I can see eyes that are lighting up with understanding and eyes that are glazing over with ministerial leadership. But when you set the song down on its groove, and you let the drummer and the bass player and the pianist work rhythmically together, then very often that's what helps the song to lift congregationally when it gets to that state. But when you're learning the song, certainly the melody is really important. So when we did The King Forevermore the other night, there was a verse which we did where I literally had my right hand on the keys, banging the whole melody out in octaves so that everybody wasn't going to miss it. It's what I do in choir practice, and I want people to learn something properly quickly. I use an example from The Empire Strikes Back to make a point at this stage sometimes, but we're going to keep moving because time is short. Sometimes you have your foreground, your middle ground, and your background. You know, your middle ground will be the padding, if you like, the orchestral sound that we have is kind of the middle ground of what we're doing. Occasionally at one instrument we'll get a wee moment, and I call that the bonus element. So there's a moment in The Splendor of the King where the trumpet, you know, the groove sitting down, the drummer and I and the bass player and the guitarist are all sitting together doing the groove, which is reasonably solid. We're assuming everybody knows the melody of The Splendor of the King at this stage, so the groove is the prominent thing. There's somebody there singing the melody with the harmony in behind. The harmony, you're starting to think middle ground. And then there's a wee moment in the middle of the basic pattern texture that's going on, when the trumpet has a dee da 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 dee da, and it's over, that's his moment gone. But at that moment, he's allowed to lift the bell up and go for it, okay? And sometimes those little touches are what create the magic that shapes a song and makes it go from nothing to somewhere. I'm not going to cover that. Playing supportively. I'm going to let the story about By Faith that we talked about, the By Faith is my digital roof, cover everything I want to say about playing supportively. You're not there to show off. Make it simple. Make it work. Make it supportive. And I'm going to move through all of that bit as well. Fewer notes than you think, particularly piano players. You don't need to drive them in. You don't need to fill every quiver. Every semi-quiver. Sorry, lots of movements are wrong, but it's not actually me. The piano is broken. I'm going to move the octave just to make it that key's particularly, but you understand what I'm saying? Where piano playing is horrifically busy, okay? And you want to avoid that covering everything all the time. Don't feel that you have to prop everybody else up. I resisted this lesson for years and years and years because I spent years teaching. And when you teach and you get music with people, you feel the need to create the structure where they... And one of the most releasing things I have learned in my own musical development is to let go a little bit and go, do you know what? If it falls apart, it falls apart. But let the space happen in music so that as a pianist, you're not so massive that there ain't no room for anything else to happen. I'm lucky now that I work with solid musicians most of the time who are comfortable doing what they do. But even with youngsters, it's very important for them to be able to have the confidence to learn to get right to the moment when they're coming in first. And sometimes when we prop them up in church, we're creating something that actually just isn't that musical and it becomes noisy. And sometimes you've got to, when you shape things, be sensitive to that. See sheet music as a travel guide, particularly for most worship songs. You know, you get the travel guide, the town of France, you can choose what you're going to take. If you want to bend the rhythm slightly, that's okay if it works better. I don't know why that's there. Some pitfalls. You know, the end of the song. Hear the love of Christ, I stand. Bang! I had somebody had a go at me once for doing that at the end of the band. The double key, when you double key this thing. Sustained pedal down all the time. You know, you're used to it, there's nothing clean about the piano, so this is more your pianist than anything else. Keep it simple. guitarists. You don't need very much equipment. Drummer is not a shoot. Organists, try and work with other people in a similar way. Mm-hmm. Simplicity is support. And all of this is because when we sing at church, in a singing church, we're singing to God as he's told us to. We're exalting Christ as he's told us to. We're obeying God as he's told us to. We're imitating God as he's told us to. We're expressing our unity. We're articulating truth. We're learning truth because we've articulated it. And we're encouraging each other in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs in a way that builds each other up. And we're also helping people to engage in those kind of ways that they would otherwise do. You can tell that section is supposed to be longer. But it's really important. I'm going to do that in a moment because I want to say this bit. You've got to keep practicing. I've reached a stage in life now, in my mid-40s, where I've evaluated the whole idea of developing long-term in a way that I never had before. Partly that's just because in a period of a couple of years, my health changed. And I had an overnight health change, which meant that I ended up in hospital for a number of months and had to decide what was really important as well as spending the time. A year after that, my father died, and so with that, any sense that I was anything other than the oldest male in the family was gone. And that changes, I think, how you see it. And I also had an unexpected third child in the middle of all of that. It's been an interesting few years. But in the middle of all of that, I've learned the importance of actually being rooted in and comfortable in what you do at this age. And I think for a lot of us, I think it's a lovely thing to feel that your life has been pointing in a particular direction for a long time and you found your groove, actually. And for me, I remember as a student having this dilemma, was I going to be interested in theology or was I going to be interested in music? And I found myself in this lovely place in the middle where I get to live my Christian life out through music. And suddenly life makes sense. And I find that a really rewarding position that God has privileged me to be in. And I think, however, that it would be very wrong for me to spend the next part of my life being wonderfully contented with that, because actually developing further and getting better at stuff is really important. And so I think it's important that we all think long-term about how we develop ourselves in our gifting as well as musicians and worship leaders. So keep practicing both your music and your leading and your style and your choosing of words. Your choosing of words. Write songs, even if nobody in the world sings them. The discipline of engaging with lyrics is very good for us as musicians. Communicate more rather than less with the people you work with. All the stuff we talked about with being band leaders, PA operators, and all those things. Work more with people rather than less. Learn to collaborate. I'm still trying this myself. Reflect more rather than less. Be self-critical. Not to the point where it debilitates you, but evaluate stuff and get better at it. Attend training events, well done. Learn from people you disagree with. If you're a natural conservative, go and appreciate the passion of some of your revolutionary friends. If you're a natural revolutionary, occasionally listen to the cautionary tales of more traditionally minded friends. But keep talking. Keep your heart and mind open to the new things the Holy Spirit wants to teach you. I'm from a very conservative evangelical background, but I'm increasingly convinced that God actually wants me to know more of him. I think God has things to say for rational, conservative thinkers, as well as the brothers and sisters of Christ who might sadly have been traditionally regarded with suspicion by me. But the most important thing is that we continue to remember that worship is not just the thing we do when we gather. Because if we want to have integrity in serving, then we've got to keep worshiping with our whole lives. And whether the music's solid or not solid, whether it's messy or whatever, matters less than where we personally stand before God, because our service will be not of very much meaning unless we're actually fully submitted to him. I would encourage you, in all this stuff, to keep that at the forefront of your mind. Now, I do want to allow a couple minutes for questions. If there are none, that's okay. If people want to talk privately, I'll stay around for a few minutes now before we get to tea. That's fine. But if there's anything anyone wants to ask that you think might be interesting for everybody, then there's about 3 minutes left. And I'll try and give a less than 3 minute answer. I love it when there's no questions. You breathed.
How do we stop it all from getting too personal at times, Jonathan?
In what sense? You mean
taking the personal out of the equation? Because worship really is so central to us. It's our very deepest being. And
you mean the identity of the person involved up front?
Yes, you want to criticize or make a comment or whatever, people can take on very quickly when it comes to worship.
Yeah. One of the things that's really helpful is to have a regular structure that actually invites comment on all the matters of church life, so that it's okay for somebody to say to the leader of the Sunday school that a particular thing, you want to think about that, and to try and create a general culture of church life which is supportively giving ideas rather than somebody feeling immediately touchy because they've been confronted with something unexpectedly. And I also, in the longer version of this, always would tell worship leaders and musicians actually to proactively seek out accountability as well, so that you can ask, you know, try that, it's more good at work. And if you seek that out, then you're being proactive about seeking that sort of advice, and that builds you up actually in your confidence as well, because sometimes you get encouragement out of it, and sometimes you get, yeah, you're right, it didn't work. And you learn to deal with the ebb and flow of that a little bit more. But you're right, there can sometimes be a defensiveness involved, because this is my personal expression of this thing that God has laid in my heart. And even though you think it's a mess, I don't. And there's got to be that regular culture of it being okay to talk. But we're all agree on receiving, because musicians prefer clapping. Anything else?
Quick question.
Yes.
Your handout that you had yesterday.
I have the handout that I had yesterday, and yes. So if you've been writing, you've been wasting your time, I'm sorry. it's on the piano there. I tried to discourage the people who were here yesterday from taking the handout away so that it wouldn't steal all the thunder from today's session. But there you are. Feel free to grab one of those on your way out. Can I pray for you? Father, I thank you for this group of people again and for the time that they've spent today in reflecting all sorts of issues, and particularly for this last hour and a half, we're thinking about these issues of music and worship. And I pray, Lord, that you will bless the service of every person in this area, in this room, and others around who maybe would have wanted to be here but had something else done. I pray, Lord, that this whole area of how we worship together in song is a place where we glorify you and enjoy you and serve you and demonstrate our love for you and actually also build each other up as well. Thank you for the gifts that you've given. Help us to hold them with open hands and use them for you. And in so doing, to make our bodies living sacrifices, which is our spiritual prayer. Come back soon.